call the committee to order. Is Representative Broad in the room? The chair will move House File 1220 to be recommended to pass, and where is it going? To be re-referred to civil law. Representative Broad, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Oftentimes I hold town hall meetings or hearings in my communities, and I ask the folks who are there, well, give me some ideas. Tell me how things can work better from the state level. And that, this bill we have before you today is exactly that. The bill came from someone who works with our Human Services Department in Leesburg County, and he came with an idea of how we can make sure that we're collecting debt in regard to welfare agencies and overpayments. Mr. Chair and members, I do have with me John Glazinski. You'll probably want him to spell his last name for you for the record. He works, again, with the Department of Human Services with Leesburg County.
Mr. Glazinski, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm John Glazinski. I work with the Leesburg County Department of Human Services. I am the financial assistant supervisor, the fiscal supervisor, finance supervisor, collection supervisor as well. Last name is spelled G-L-I-S-C-Z-I-N-S-K-I.
I didn't get it right.
Back in, if I may proceed.
Please proceed.
Back in 1998, originally came up with this idea after speaking with the Department of Employment about acquiring access to unemployment and employment information on individuals, after I realized that this information, this computer data, was not available to corrections officers. I contacted the department and asked if my collections people could have this information, and they said, according to state statute, we're not in the 11 exceptions to the people who have access to this information. I found it a bit odd at the time, because the same information that we're seeking to be able to access is information that our income maintenance unit that determines eligibility for AFDC and, I'm sorry, now called MFIP, and food stamps and general assistance, use this information to find out if the information that's being provided to them by the client is accurate. And when they find discrepancies, this creates an overpayment. A lot of times an overpayment is created by that information that they receive from what they call the IV screen, or the Income Verification Eligibility System. This information used against what the client has generates an overpayment. This overpayment is then turned over to my collections unit, and the collections unit takes this information, contacts the individual about the overpayment, seeks reimbursement, and from that point, if the client doesn't contact us, we will seek a judgment. We go to our conciliation court. We'll get a judgment against the individual, and from that point, we want to seek wage garnishment. By this point, we've probably lost contact with the individual. They're not contacting us, and we would like to find out more about them as to where they're working. The information that about their employment, what created the overpayment in the first place, is not available to my collections officers because they don't follow any exceptions. So that's when I came up with the thought, well, we need to get the same information that created the overpayment in the first place to the people who need to collect the overpayment. And that's when I contacted Representative Broad.
Representative Broughton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and members, I also have with me here today Lee Nelson, who's the Director for Unemployment Insurance Legal Affairs. He also spoke with both myself and Mr. Glazinski in terms of trying to work this through the process in a way that protected data privacy and everything that is important to Deed as well.
Mr. Nelson, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Unemployment Insurance Legal Affairs for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The only thing I'd like to say is that the department supports me.
Thank you. Questions for members? Representative Goodwin.
Oh, right. Mr. Chair and Representative Brad, I have a question here. It looks to me in the current law, like number six would cover, on page two, number six would already cover public and private agencies responsible for administering publicly financed programs. So maybe there's an interpretation of the of that that's not covering what you're trying to cover, but perhaps it's the interpretation and not the missing part of law that's the problem here.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Goodwin. You are right, it covers the monitoring of it, but it certainly doesn't make clear in statute in terms of their ability to use it for the recapture or the overpayment of debt. So it's really just an attempt to make sure that that is a legal use of the data. Maybe Mr. Glazinski maybe has another comment about that.
Again, maybe the department.
Let Mr. Glazinski come in if he wants.
I think Representative Broad clearly did that.
Okay, Representative Goodwin.
I'm wondering too if and I don't see it here, but maybe I'm missing it. What about child support payments? For the getting the information for child support payments. That doesn't look like it's included in current law. Have you looked at that? And am I wrong?
Mr. Nelson.
Is it covered?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, that is both covered by federal law and it's in 256 in the Human Services Statute, which provides them access. The federal law also mandates that everyone seeking child support collection has access to this data.
Thank you.
In statute and in federal law.
Thank you.
Further questions?
We don't have law.
Seeing none, the chair renews his motion that House File 1220 be recommended pass and re-referred to civil law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Broad. Representative Johnson.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Severson.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1220 for
576.
I'm sorry,
the other one,
get the right one. House File 5782 for consideration, passage, and referral to Jobs and Economic Development.
Representative Severson moves House File 572 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Policy and Finance. Representative Johnson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, before we start, I just kind of want to preface the whole bill that this is here in Commerce because of Sections 2, 5, and 6, and I think that pretty much covers the Commerce-related sections, and I'd like to keep the debate and the discussion on those sections, and we'll let the other committees do their jobs.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. This is the meth bill that we have been talking about all session, and I think you are my fifth or sixth stop now. And keep in mind as we talk about this that I have at least three more, probably four more committees to go through, so there may be issues that arise where I will tell you that we'll keep working on it, and we'll have the opportunity to do that. I'm not going to give you a long, stirring speech on methamphetamines because you are going to hear from several people today that are much closer to this who can give you more compelling personal testimony on it. Let me just say, though, before I tell you what the bill says, I represent suburban Minnesota, and I often hear some of my constituents and even some members around here talk about the meth problem as a really serious rural Minnesota problem, which, of course, is true. It is a serious rural Minnesota problem, but I can tell you that it is here in the Twin Cities as well. It's certainly in my district. I've been talking to kids at my schools in high school, and they're using meth. Most of them aren't convinced that it's as dangerous as we know it really is, because nothing really horrible has happened yet in my suburb. But those days aren't far away if we don't take some pretty significant action this year. And that's what this bill does. Let me just point out the three sections that you referenced, Mr. Chairman. If you go to your bill on page 2, line 22, that section are the restrictions on the precursor drugs, on the pseudoephedrine products. And that is probably the most controversial part of the bill, and that's the part that I think you want to talk about as a committee today. Let me just give you in a nutshell what it says. Products that have pseudoephedrine or ephedrine in them, something like Sudafed or Tylenol Cold and Sinus or something like that, in a tablet form, a powder tablet form, will be restricted from purchase, will be restricted from sale unless a pharmacist or a pharmacist technician sells them. And I have an amendment that would also add a pharmacist or a pharmacy clerk to that definition, Mr. Chairman.
You want to take care of that right now?
That would be great.
Okay. Representative Severson moves the A23 amendment. Is that the correct one?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. We'll just move that and get it in shape. The author wants to discuss the bill. All in favor of the A23 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
So pseudoephedrine products that are in tablet form can only be sold by a pharmacist, a pharmacist technician, or a pharmacy clerk. Only two boxes can be sold at a time, up to 6 grams, in one visit to the store. And over a 30-day period, you cannot purchase more than 6 grams of a pseudoephedrine product in tablet form. That is approximately 7 to 8 average Actifed or Sudafed boxes over a 30-day period. You must be 18 years old to purchase the product. You must sign a log to purchase the product. And there are exceptions. The exceptions are liquid product, anything in a gel cap form, pediatric or children's products, and then going forward, anything that the Board of Pharmacy finds cannot be essentially made into meth. There is no such product right now, but there's a belief that the market will probably create one if we put this restriction in place. That, in essence, Mr. Chairman, is the Schedule 5 or the restriction portion of the bill. The other two sections you talked about simply just refer back to Section 2, so they don't add anything new to the bill.
Okay, would you like to go through your testifiers?
That would be great. I would like to start with Tim O'Malley from the BCA.
All the testifiers would introduce yourselves and then just proceed with your testimony as you come to the table. Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Representative Johnson has asked me to give just a quick overview of methamphetamine. I know this has been a topic around the legislature this year and in past years, and that many of you are familiar with it. But I'll spend just a few minutes and go fairly quickly through the beginning of a PowerPoint presentation, and then towards the end focus much more specifically on pseudoephedrine and the Schedule 5 issue. Methamphetamine and methamphetamine labs in particular have created a very, very serious problem in Minnesota. I'm not going to talk about many specific cases in terms of individuals, but as you can see from the before and after photos, now finished with one too, it has a devastating effect on individuals as well as communities and governments and a number of other entities. Just real quickly, children are often found at meth labs in these kinds of conditions. This is not an exaggeration. We have children in almost half the meth labs that are found in Minnesota living in horrendous conditions. Weapons are also often found at meth labs. Methamphetamine manufacturing, methamphetamine dealing, methamphetamine using is a very, very dangerous activity. Whether it's where you're making money or if you're an addict, no matter what, there are robberies, there's money, there's drugs involved. One of the well-recognized characteristics of a meth addict is paranoia. And not only are they paranoid of their own family, of neighbors, of the police, on top of all that, the police actually are after them. And it does become a dangerous situation for law enforcement, for neighbors, for family members, and for themselves. So they often have weapons in a very paranoid state. Meth labs themselves blow up. There are fires. If they were making widgets, this would still be a very, very dangerous activity. The fact that there's methamphetamine involved makes it that much worse, that there's now something going up the noses of our impressionable teens and kids in schools. But even if they weren't doing that, it's created very, very dangerous situations, a few of which I'll describe in a moment. Again, the conditions under which methamphetamine made is really horrendous. It's an environmental concern. It's a family concern. It's a children concern. 4 years ago, I came down to the legislature with a group of people, and a number of us testified about methamphetamine in Minnesota and labs in particular and where it might be going. This is one of the slides from that presentation. I would just point out a couple things. It's other states in the Midwest and where they were for a period of 1995 through 2000 in terms of methamphetamine laboratory seizures. You can see Missouri was high, and I'll get to that in a minute, too. But if you look at Iowa and Minnesota, back in 95, we were tracking fairly closely. And you can see what happened to Iowa by the year 2000 and then where we were. Again, Wisconsin is behind us. They're starting to face it now. Just a little historical perspective. Here's what's happened in the meantime in Minnesota. This is the number of meth labs seized in Minnesota. This is a very conservative number. These are the number of labs that were reported to the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. There are other labs that have been seized that we're aware of, but we wanted to use the most accurate and conservative number available. This is it. The cost to public entities, to the government, to a wide range of public sector agencies is incredible. In the year 2004, we again conservatively estimated that it cost the state of Minnesota $176 million to deal with the methamphetamine problem here, and it's broken down by the percentages there. The estimated ongoing cost, if no significant measures are taken, is that it'll be at least $130 million a year ongoing. Again, some of those costs are related to law enforcement. It's a very painstaking and detailed process to dismantle a lab. There's OSHA requirements, there's equipment requirements, there's supply requirements. It takes a lot of staffing hours, and it takes a lot of protective gear, as you see here. So each one, whether they're making just a couple grams or they're making ounces, are very dangerous and very costly. Here's some of the other states, Iowa, Missouri, and Oklahoma in particular. And I would just point out real quickly again, if you look where Iowa and Missouri were in 1999, actually all of these, Oklahoma too, somewhere under 500, that's where we're at. We're in the 300-400 range and climbing. So we're where they were 5 years ago or so, and you can see what's happened in some of those other states. And I think that'll be telling when we talk about some of their efforts that have failed in those states in the meantime. Pseudoephedrine is the sole essential element for methamphetamine. If you do not have pseudoephedrine, you cannot make methamphetamine. That's why, one of the reasons why Representative Johnson and others have focused their efforts on the pseudoephedrine aspect of the cooking process. Pseudoephedrine, just to put it a little bit in perspective, that box up there is one that I'm sure everybody's familiar with. I have one here. The back of the box lays out, and this goes to the issue of the limitations on how much can be purchased. If you were to, one box, the box shirt up there has 24 tablets, 30 milligrams. You multiply that out, that comes out to 720 milligrams of pseudoephedrine. When you go through the process of turning pseudoephedrine into methamphetamine, it's almost a one-to-one yield. You'll end up with about 0.75 grams of methamphetamine. So from one box, if you have the other ingredients, which are common household ingredients and can be substituted, pseudoephedrine is the only essential one. If you have that in a matter of a few hours, you can make 0.75 grams, the average amount that a moderate user of methamphetamine might use in a night or on a weekend. The box itself talks about the limitations of use of this medicine. And it says that you should use it at most for 6 days. And after 6 days, you should consult a doctor before taking any further of this medication. So that's why the number of tablets here, after 6 days, you really should stop. And anybody who bought a couple boxes is easily a 6-day supply. And again, you can buy up to 7 or 8 boxes in a month, so you'd have them around. One last thing on the process, just to show, I guess, why it is that pseudoephedrine is the sole essential ingredient and why the process isn't that complicated. Here's the molecular structure for pseudoephedrine, the hydrogen, carbon, oxygen molecules. You take away two of them, you put the hydrogen back, and you got methamphetamine. That's the only difference between the two substances. One a lawful substance and one an illegal substance. Other states have tried. I mentioned a minute ago Missouri and showed you the stats on Missouri. Missouri has tried to combat their meth lab problem, which really skyrocketed in the last decade, and they have absolutely failed. In 2001, they passed an over-the-counter restriction for 9 grams or 3 packages, thinking that that would curtail the number of labs. Instead, they had 2,100-some labs in 2001. It went up 29% the next year. Then they, in response to that ongoing crisis, they passed new legislation that made it only 6 grams or 2 packages. It had to be behind the counter or in plain view of the salesperson. Again, in response to that, the labs went up another 9%. Oklahoma. Here are the lab statistics for them, isolated from that other slide. You can see they've increased steadily, went well over 1,000 for a few years, and then dropped in 2004. Here's a closer look at the last 2 years, 2003 and 2004. This is a by-the-month accounting for the number of labs seized in Oklahoma. The black bars are 2003, starting with January. So you can see that it was up about 100, a little over 100, stayed up there. It goes up and down a little bit during the summer months. And then it goes up again. The white bars now are 2004. Overall, it's climbing until right there. In April of 2004, they passed legislation nearly identical to what is proposed today. The results are very, very impressive. Labs immediately started plummeting, the number of labs in the states, until you get to comparing December of 2003 with December of 2004, and it's a 78% reduction in that month, and that decline has continued through the months since December of 2004. Oklahoma today is safer than it's ever been, and Missouri today is more dangerous than it's ever been. We've talked to people in law enforcement in Missouri, and what's happening is they share a border. Any states that are sharing a border with Oklahoma, the cooks are moving over there, and that's where they're getting the pseudoephedrine, and their labs are continuing to skyrocket. It seems that in most, I shouldn't say most, in some states, there has been a defining moment that led the legislature to take action, or rallied a community and a group to be so outraged that something drastic had to happen. Indiana and Oklahoma are two of those states. Oklahoma already has Schedule 5. Their catalyst was that 3 state troopers were shot and killed by methamphetamine users in separate incidents in a very short period of time. The state was outraged and said, we've got to get methamphetamine under control. We've got to quit having these labs all over the state. In Indiana, just a few weeks ago, a young girl, Katie Coleman, was murdered. Her body was found in a creek 5 days after an Amber Alert was issued. She was, and this is the press on it, she was not killed because of a sexual assault, a kidnapping for ransom, or random violence. She was killed because she stumbled across a meth lab in her neighborhood. The 10-year-old's body was found January 30th of this year in a creek several miles from her home in Crothersville. It's a town of like 1,600 in rural Indiana. Her hands were tied behind her back. The cause of death was drowning. Charles James Hickman, charged with murder, was trying to intimidate Katie, into not revealing the existence of a meth lab which was operating in an apartment near her home. Pastor John Pierce at her funeral said, told the crowd that Coleman's death should serve as a, quote, wake-up call. He went on to say, if Katie hadn't been walking by a meth lab, she would be alive today. The plan by the methamphetamine cook was to simply intimidate her into not revealing that a meth lab was being made in an apartment not far from her home. We have had a number of moments in Minnesota, and I'll go through them these very quickly, relating to methamphetamine and meth labs. Not long ago, a few months back in Little Dilworth, Minnesota, there was a meth dealer and a meth customer who got into a disagreement. The dealer threw him in the trunk, drove him around, took him out to dump him in a field. As he pulled him out of the trunk, changed his mind, grabbed a hatchet, and buried in his head. In Fountain, Minnesota, a meth addict and cook was making methamphetamine in his home, started a fire accidentally, he burned to death. Long Prairie in Minneapolis, I would think all of you probably remember this one. A meth addict broke into a home in Minneapolis, murdered an elderly gentleman and his disabled adult daughter. About 10 days later, they went up to Little Long Prairie, Minnesota, absolute 100% total randomness, picked a home, went in there, two of them, mom's sleeping on the couch, teenage kids are sleeping in their respective rooms. These three people are tortured, are caused to hear and see what's happening to other family members, and they're brutally murdered with their throats cut. In Little Pillager, Minnesota, a trailer court on the edge of town, three people involved in the methamphetamine business, again, are murdered, shot in the head. The woman in her 20s went through a similar experience to the teenage girl in Long Prairie. The torture that she went through is nearly unspeakable. Our crime scene team was there. The DCH crime scene team was there. I happened to stop at that scene because I was in the area when it happened, and it is probably the most gruesome and terrible crime scene I've seen in law enforcement, and I started in my career, and I started in 1977. Elizabeth, Minnesota, a meth environment, meth lab there, a couple of young kids, mom's not very accountable, she leaves, the fire starts, the two children die. Grove City, straight run-of-the-mill search warrant, law enforcement does them all the time, they're going through the door, the guy tries to grab a gun, wrestles with the deputy, fortunately no one dies, the man's charged with attempted murder. This is a man who I talked to the sheriff up there. This is a man who was involved in his church, in his community, had children, had a good job 2 or 3 years ago, started getting into meth, spiraled downward. He ends up being charged with attempted murder of a sheriff's deputy and then commits suicide in jail. Gilbert, Minnesota, another little town, northern Minnesota. There's 2 or 3 bars probably in the town at midnight. Meth user's walking out of the bar. The dealer sees him. He owes him some money. He grabs him again. They duct tape him, throw him in the trunk, drive around for about 18 hours. This is last August. It's in the 80-degree range. They take him out. They thump him, beat him up pretty bad. We find him at 6 o'clock that night with 10 bullet holes in his head. Hancock, Minnesota. This got a fair amount of attention again. This is about a year or so ago, I suppose, maybe two. Methamphetamine investigation in Minneapolis leads to a lab in Little Hancock. SWAT team goes up there as they're going up to the farmhouse. The cook, who's very high on methamphetamine, comes out with a shotgun, opens fire on the officers. They return fire and kill them. There's a whole bunch of them. This could go on. In the Twin Cities, a couple teenage girls in Eagan were molested by a meth dealer. In Burnsville, a 16-year-old girl dies of a meth overdose, and the autopsy determines she was raped before she died. We had an informant killed up in Mountain Iron, another little town, because the word on the street was that he was cooperating with law enforcement to find meth labs. These horrendous situations have been going on for a couple years. They are continuing today. Something's going to happen in the next 3 years. We're going to go in one direction or another. This is my last slide and my last before and after, just for you to consider. There are alternatives available. I recognize, and Representative, I know, has discussed that there's always a balance at the legislature between public safety and private sector interests. The harm caused here has resulted in, I think, a very comprehensive bill that is no more cumbersome or burdensome than it needs to be. I think it is a very well-reasoned and wise approach to a very devastating epidemic. The last thing I would just point out is that I have some medicines up here in front of us. These are the ones that would be controlled. These would be Schedule 5. Under this bill, a purchaser would have to go to a pharmacy, show an ID, be 18 years old, sign a log to get these. These would not be. And these are just a small sampling. Shelves and stores all over are full of these products. These are the gel caps. These are the liquids. There's also powders that would not be affected by this. You could walk in any store 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and buy these products if this bill goes through. And these products all contain pseudoephedrine. This one has 30 milligrams, that one has 30, this has 60, and that one has 30. It's the exact same medicine, pseudoephedrine, as in those products. It's just that those, it's an easy conversion to make it into methamphetamine. We have never found these at a methamphetamine lab in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. Twyla Brace.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to mix the pro and con?
Could, if members would like to ask questions, we can probably take those now.
I have two more pro witnesses.
Okay. Which ones are
Sheriff Schultz and Hillary Caligiuri.
Okay, why don't we do that then? We'll go to Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask, is pseudoephedrine also a drug of abuse by itself?
No, not that I'm aware of. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't believe it is. I mean, it is a drug, and it has some effect, obviously effect on the body. It drives up the sinuses and so on. But it is, in our experience, it is only an abused substance, which it is now, an abused substance, when it goes through the conversion process and is made into methamphetamine.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. O'Malley, and you said that gel capsules haven't been used in Minnesota to produce it. I understand that, but I understand that nationally there have been some instances that it can be used. It's just a little bit harder. And if we're going to disallow one and the other one's just a little bit harder, isn't there going to be people just shift to that since it's been done nationally in other places in the nation?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's true. It is possible to use these products and make methamphetamine. It has been done in controlled settings in labs by the DEA. It has not been used, as I said, in Minnesota, and it has been used, to my knowledge, not much, if at all, throughout the United States by criminals. It is possible. There is an added level and an added extraction process that is more complicated. I think this was one of those items that was looked at for this legislation in an attempt to be reasonable and be no more burdensome than necessary on the private sector and yet control the labs. The other thing I guess I would point out is that in Oklahoma, they did this and it has been extremely effective, and I don't know that they have seen these coming up yet.
Yeah. Other questions for Representative Zeller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was curious, Mr. O'Malley, what percentage is made here and made in Mexico or imported from other areas? And my second question is, what happened in Oklahoma to the meth use, the actual use by the addicts after their legislation went into place?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the percentage of methamphetamine that is imported into Minnesota is in the range of 70 to 80%. By far, most of the methamphetamine that is being abused here comes from outside Minnesota. The labs make up a smaller percent. The labs themselves, though, have that dangerousness element to them for children and environment, all that. So that's one aspect that I think is critical. Secondly, law enforcement, and I believe Kanawha County Sheriff Steve Schultz is going to testify today. Law enforcement has been overwhelmed by the labs. Every lab takes hours and hours and a lot of resources. The hope and the plan is, quite frankly, that our drug task forces and agents at the BCA can redirect their resources and their efforts away from all the meth labs and start focusing where the brunt of the methamphetamine is coming from, and that's the Mexican and California and Arizona cartels. As far as the meth use in Oklahoma, I don't know the answer to that, sir, and I'll try to find out for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Steve Schultz. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Steve Schultz. I'm the sheriff of Kanawha County. Mora is the county seat. I'm about 70 miles north of here. I did our first lab in Kanawha County in 1997. Since then, I have been to approximately 350 labs in East Central Minnesota. The one common thing that I've seen in every lab I have been in, and it's a bunch, is pseudoephedrine. I have yet to not see a firearm at a meth lab. I have seen numerous kids in meth labs, and to be honest with you, our county is devastated by this issue. And I don't think that we're any different than most counties in greater Minnesota. We have the sheriffs out there basically band together to do this. what I thought I would do is just take it through a two-week period of time, which was the last 2 weeks. I was scheduled to testify 2 weeks ago, Thursday, down here, and we did a lab in Kanawha County where there was we arrested six individuals for manufacturing methamphetamine. At that lab, there was approximately 25 gallons of sludge, which basically should correlate out to about 5 pounds of methamphetamine. I know that we talk about minimal labs. They always talk ounce or two here or there, eight balls, those types of things. That's if you catch them relatively quick. These labs can go on and on and on and just devastate a little segment of a county for cleanup and other problems. A week later, we could go today, a deputy sheriff that works for me, we stop a car, the female driver reaches into her purse, the deputy's hollering at her, the undercover narcotics guy dives into the passenger seat of the car to stop the assault and the other police officer from dying. The vehicle goes down the road at 60 miles an hour and the deputy tumbles out of the vehicle. Sunday afternoon, husband, wife, two small children out for a walk in Kanawha County, little county township road, just going for a walk. There's a lab set up in the ditch on that township road that's active, and this whole family walks up to it. I represent about 16,000 people, is all I'm about. Those people in my community, I can tell you, want me here, they want me screaming and hollering, and they want this legislation to pass. You heard numbers that 80% of the dope coming into this, the methamphetamine coming into this state is from Mexico or Mexican meth. We don't see a whole lot. And I don't know that rural Minnesota sees a whole lot of Mexican meth. We see a whole lot of fluff manufactured right there in those counties. When we talk about time restraints, I have six deputies that work full-time for me. I have a narcotics guy and a general investigation guy. The lab 2 weeks ago, just to give you a flavor of the time that he's talking about, all six of my deputies were there. We started that operation at 11:30 at night. I got home at 7 o'clock the next evening, and I was the first one to go home. The following Thursday night, this incident occurs at about 8:30 at night, and I, again, am the first one to go home, and that is 10 o'clock the next morning, and that's because I'm at the hospital with the two deputies that are injured. Then again, on Sunday, we have another lab. That starts at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I, again, am the first one home, and that's 2:30 in the morning. I have six guys that work the road for me. You can see from that two-week block, and that is not unusual. I mean, that is not an unusual situation for us. We're drawing resources from other counties to try and curb this problem. This legislation is vital to counties in general, period, across this state. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association strongly supports this bill. We need this passed. It is essential for our communities, our public safety, for the safety of law enforcement across this state. It's devastating our counties. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff. I'd like to get through some of the other testimony here because we only have another hour to get through everything. Hillary from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I'm not even going to attempt your last name, so I'll let you take care of that for me.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's pronounced just like it's spelled, Caligari.
That's what I was going to guess.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Hillary Caligari, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. Representative Rukavina, of course, does know how to pronounce my name, but only the Rangers do. I started my career at the Attorney General's Office, where I was the head of the criminal division and also had the opportunity to prosecute meth labs traveling around the state at that time. So I've seen the meth problem from both angles, both from the Minneapolis and Hennepin County side as well as the greater Minnesota side. As Sheriff Schultz told you, many smaller communities and counties across the state are being devastated by meth. But it is not just a rural problem as it is often publicized. Last year in Hennepin County, our meth cases increased by more than 20% over the year 2003, even though our overall drug case remains steady. So meth cases now represent about 15% of our total drug caseload in Hennepin County. A couple of times each month, we charge a case that typically involves a group of young adults or juveniles that go out to the Walmart or to the Mills Food Farm, buy a mountain of Sudafed or other cold medicine. The alert store clerk calls the police. They do a search in the parking lot, and they often in the car find other materials that are used for manufacturing methamphetamine. A lot of these defendants actually live outside of Hennepin County but are coming into Hennepin County to do their smurfing or shopping for pills. A few years ago, we had a guy who set a house on fire in Maple Grove when he tried to cook meth in the basement. He was a friend of the woman who was house-sitting at that place. The owners had no idea that their house was being used as a meth lab right in Maple Grove in Hennepin County. And as Mr. O'Malley mentioned, there's probably no better or more horrifying example of the statewide impact of methamphetamine than the murders committed by Jonathan Carpenter and Christopher Earle in April of 2003 in Park Rapids and in Minneapolis, proving that methamphetamine is a breeding ground for some of the worst violence imaginable. Clearly, meth is not just a drug that harms the individual user. It's something that harms many other people, including whole communities. Police and prosecutors statewide know that meth breeds a host of problems: violent crimes, burglaries, thefts, child abuse, child neglect, even public health risks from the toxic chemicals that are used to manufacture methamphetamine. And meth labs in particular have become a very serious burden to local law enforcement and local prosecutors, and really the entire community in which they're found. So county attorneys around the state support stronger laws to stop people from acquiring the ingredients that are needed to manufacture methamphetamine. I use pseudoephedrine myself, but when somebody tries to buy 20 cartons of this stuff, it should be pretty clear that they've got more than just a bad cold. In a 2002 case in Hennepin County, we pulled some meth lab complaints and took a look at them. There's a 2002 case where a number of defendants were detained after buying 7 boxes of Sudafed at a Kmart right in Minneapolis, right on Lake Street. Even though Kmart has enacted a 2-box limit, these folks got around that limit by going through the self-service lanes, which are now present at more and more stores. So they bought 7 boxes. When the police questioned one of these defendants, her comment was that she and her accomplices came in from out of state. They expressly came to Minnesota to purchase Sudafed-type drugs in mass quantities because it is too difficult to make such purchases in other states. That is not how we want Minnesota known among the budding meth cooks around this country. So for that reason, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association supports getting pseudoephedrine off of regular shelving in the stores, restricting the age of the purchaser and the amount that can be purchased, and keeping a log to track purchases, because a number of boxes as a limit alone won't do it, as these cooks go around from store to store buying up Sudafed. We need to stop access to meth at the source, and that means making it as hard as possible to acquire the chemicals that are used to manufacture meth. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Phyla Brace.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Well, you are the Commerce. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm from Citizens Council on Healthcare. We're a free market, nonprofit healthcare policy organization. And you're the Commerce Committee, so I decided I would bring you two different pieces that this bill impacts in commerce. One of them having to do with access, and the other with process. So let's just talk about access first. I did a little survey on my way here. I stopped at 3 different places that sell Sudafed. So I stopped at Walgreens and Cub and Rainbow, and I looked for gel caps in just Sudafed. And I noticed here that this is acetaminophen, dextromorphine, something succinate, and Sudafed. And this one is acetaminophen, dextromorphine, and Sudafed. So, and this one has 2 different ingredients, and this one I think has 4. In fact, in all those three pharmacies that I was in, I found no just Sudafed gel caps or anything else that I could find. And for those of us who use Sudafed, and I am one person who uses Sudafed regularly to prevent sinus infections, that would mean that we'd have to use like guaifenesin or guaia. I can't remember what it is, but it's a cough or an expectorant or a cough depressant or acetaminophen, which is Tylenol sort of thing. So we'd have to actually have something extra in order to have anything that we didn't have to sign in the log with. So my point, and the other thing is that any of the pills that were gel caps that had all these different other ingredients in them seem to be about twice as expensive per pill as the ones that were straight Sudafed. So what you're looking at when it comes to access, and you're the Commerce Committee interested in, you know, how commerce works, is that if you actually don't want to be part of signing the log and you want to get out of the pharmacy quickly and you don't want to have someone tracking you, you cannot have the singular ingredients unless they actually start selling it in the stores. So that's the first thing. The other has to do with process, and we're concerned about the constitutionality of the bill. And so I just want you to know that we understand that Sudafed is a legal over-the-counter product. This bill doesn't plan to change that, but it's going to require registration for its use. And it will, the registration, the log will contain private medical information. Now, while this bill is silent on actually whether this is going to be a paper or electronic log, the Senate bill isn't. And furthermore, this bill is silent on police access to the log, but I have noticed that Amendment A-20 would actually provide police access to this log, and there is no search warrant for that. And what you have to realize is that this log is actually a gathering of evidence tool. And typically when the police gather evidence, they, of course, need a search warrant in order to do it. And although they might not be able to use this information in the court of law because they didn't have a search warrant, it provides them with the extra information they need to go hunting or fishing for people who they might want to look at as possibly being guilty. So I really feel this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment rights against search and seizure. I have on what you are being handed out the actual language of the Fourth Amendment, unless anyone isn't sure what it says. And I'd also like you to think just a little bit into the future about what this means for purchasing other products, because there are other products which do damage to humans. And we're not saying that meth is not a problem. It is a problem. But here at the legislature, you need to realize how your decisions can be precedent-setting and what it means for the future of citizens' rights and the ability to buy and sell. And so just look at alcohol for just a minute. There's a lot of people who actually buy alcohol and they drink and they drive and people are killed. Is it possible that this could set a precedent for other substances and people's buying and purchasing information be access required on a log and perhaps on a police log that's available to the police to go searching for people who might and might not be guilty? So we have some ideas, and they're on that list for you, is making the drug actually a prescription medication and then authorizing it that physicians can leave standing orders at the patient's preferred pharmacy that they can pick up two packets. The packages would indeed be behind the counter as you're looking at, but it would be, and then if you're actually going to move towards a log, which we don't like at all, for anyone who doesn't have a standing order, at least there should be a search warrant. That's the least that should be required in this bill. And then finally, that you should prohibit in law the creation of a statewide electronic consumer tracking system. And I know that that has been talked about already, because obviously if someone is going to try and prevent another person from buying the 6 grams in 30 days, they're going to have to know somehow what else they have bought anywhere else. I mean, that's what the law says, and how are they going to do it without a tracking system? So I ask you to consider that and those concerns about access and about process. And if you let A-20 go onto the bill, then I would suggest that it needs to go back to civil law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Price. We do have four more testifiers, so if you could, everybody could keep their testimony as to the point as possible and try to confine it to what we're dealing with here in this committee, I'd appreciate it. Buzz Anderson?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Buzz Anderson with the Minnesota Retailers Association. The lady in front of me is a private citizen, and she asked if she could go ahead of me because she's got to get back to work. So with your permission, I'd like to let her go first, and then I'll come back.
Would that be Valerie?
Yes.
Valerie Rose. Please come forward. You could state your name for the record and be as brief and to the point as possible.
Hi, I've got it right now here. So, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and fellow committee members. I'm Valerie Ralstead. I live in Fridley, Senate District 58. I'm a mom with two daughters, 17 and an almost 14-year-old, and a son who is 10 years old. Back in February, my children came down with the flu and the cold all at the same time. I went to Target after work to get cold medicine for them. I had to get different types because the oldest can take pills, but my other two children have to do liquids instead. I got different kinds plus because they all do not have the same needs. Plus, I bought at the same time cough drops and Sudocare vapor plugs and refill. That was all I had to buy so that when I went to check out, I was told that I could not get all of these things because the register would only let me get three items. I had a total of seven items, some of these over on this side. Because I had worked at Target before and knew the cashier, she did it in two transactions for me. There were no signs saying you could only get three cold medicines. I felt angry that it was wrong to care for my family and that I might be doing something illegally. As I was leaving, two lanes down from me, there was the head cashier telling another consumer that she could not buy any more than three cold items that she was trying to purchase on clearance to save her family money. This whole incident made me so mad that I could not care for my family that when I got home, I sent off emails to Representative Barb Goodwin and to Senator Saavedra Chaudhry. I'm a mom who wants to care for her family and I do not want to feel like a criminal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Buzz Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you again. My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm with the Minnesota Retailers Association. I appreciate this opportunity to speak to the committee. The meth issue is a very, very serious problem, and everybody is going to acknowledge that. Our association has actually been dealing with this issue for over a year in conjunction with the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, the Minnesota Grocers Association, and with the Minnesota Convenience Store Industry, namely the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. We've been looking at other states, and we've been talking to officials all over the country to try to find an answer to how to deal effectively with this issue. Some of us have even visited recovering meth addicts at meth recovery centers so that we can get a better handle on what their thinking is and where they get their products and so on and so forth. The Minnesota Grocers Association and the Minnesota Pharmacists Association have been able to secure a $100,000 grant from an organization in Washington, D.C. to put together employee training packets to go to every retailer in the state so they know how to recognize suspicious behavior and how to be able to more adequately contact law enforcement when they think something is going wrong. We know that our members are responding because, you see, our store owners, their managers, and their employees live in the same communities that all of you represent. And they raise their kids there, too. They've seen the very devastating effects of meth in their communities, and they do want to do something about it. They voluntarily, many of them, in fact, most of them have voluntarily put the Sudafed-type products behind the counter or in locked display cases, while also limiting the number of packages that people can buy, particularly of the Sudafed-type product that meth addicts and meth cooks are most often trying to seek out. Some of our larger members have been programming their point-of-sale system so that clerks are prompted if somebody tries to buy more than two packages, three packages, the clerks are prompted to say, you can't buy any more because that is our store policy. And that includes gel caps and liquids, too. They're actually limiting your sales to two boxes or 6 grams, and that includes the gel caps and liquids. They provided training for their employees to watch for suspicious behavior, and this training involves looking for more than just the purchase of excess Sudafed. Let me pass around a poster that you're going to be able to find shortly in stores all over Minnesota, and I should say in store employee break rooms. And it's a breakdown of the kind of products that people might try to buy if they're putting together a meth lab. And I think you find it really very interesting. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to just pass that around, starting with Representative Mulray. Now, the reason we think this is important, because if you're going to try to make meth, you also need heat, starting fluid, denatured alcohol, camp stove gas, Grano matches, rock salt, batteries, coffee filters, and other components. And yes, even though Sudafed might be the only active ingredient, the one single ingredient you always need, you do also always need anhydrous ammonia or red phosphorus. So you're either going to have anhydrous ammonia or you're going to have a whole bunch of matches. So that's why we try to get people to get keyed into looking for suspicious behavior. And believe it or not, it is working, because our stores have seen a whole number of suspicious acts, or what appear to be suspicious acts, and they've been calling law enforcement, and has led to numerous drug busts as a result of people reporting what we believe to be suspicious behavior. At the beginning of the session, we went to the House and the Senate and the Governor's Office, and we actually asked that a legislation be adopted to limit the number of boxes that people can buy of the single active ingredient products like Sudafed and Actifed, and also to put restrictions on the gel caps and liquids as well, but to put lesser restrictions on them because they're not sought after as much. And we try to suggest a whole number of options for those other less sought after type products, because stores come in all sizes and shapes, and we want to make sure that stores, whether in a big town or a small town, can accommodate what would be most effective to try to prevent this problem. We've also asked for a special standard for convenience stores, because in some small towns, convenience stores are the only store left. There is no pharmacy. And so we asked in this initial effort that smaller boxes of maybe packets of 4 tablets be sold, and that they be placed behind the counter so people can't get access to them. And these are actually called personal consumption packs. And limit those to actually 2 boxes per sale, too. So when the purse is done, they can get to a bigger town when they do their shopping and wherever else. As a side note, just keep in mind that a few weeks ago, I went to my computer and I Googled, how do I buy Sudafed? At one site, I was allowed to buy 99 boxes at a time. At another site, I was allowed to buy 500 boxes at a time. At another site, I was allowed to buy 1,200 boxes at a time. So, you know, we're trying our best, but, you know, you can't stop these sales that are happening on the Internet. We've also asked for more oversight for what we consider to be illegitimate wholesalers in Minnesota who are selling to illegitimate retailers who we think are actually selling these in large quantities, these boxes of Sudafed, actually in cases going to these stores, and they're going right out the back door to people who are trying to put meth labs together. These are not legitimate retailers that we're talking about. A number of other states have looked at Schedule 5 and rejected it, and those states include Illinois, Colorado, Wyoming, North Dakota, Iowa, who had a Schedule 5 bill on the floor and altered it, although it still has some segments of Schedule 5, California and Washington. And according to the DEA, labs in 2003 in California dropped 27%, and preliminary data in 2004 showed that they dropped 50%. And I think I didn't get to hear Deputy Commissioner or Deputy Superintendent O'Malley's comments about whether meth use has dropped in Oklahoma. I understand labs have dropped, but meth use has not. And I just what I've heard anecdotally. I don't know that for sure. We also oppose it because hundreds of Minnesotans don't have pharmacies in their community. In fact, there's 121 communities that don't have pharmacies in Minnesota, and pharmacies in rural Minnesota are closing at 10 to 12 years. So do the math, and you'll find out it's not going to take long, and there's going to be a whole lot more communities without pharmacies. Oklahoma also passed Schedule 5. But they also passed a law in their Schedule 5 proposal that says that when you're arrested for meth and you're arrested for meth use or production, you don't have to be offered bail. And I just want to pose the question, is the reason that meth labs are going down in Oklahoma because we're actually putting these people behind bars. When I visited a meth recovery center, a meth addict said to me, thank God I was put in jail, because had you let me out on bail, I would be out the next day making meth or taking meth. Is that the real reason that meth production is down in Oklahoma? I don't know, but I think we need an answer to that. The DEA said to Congress last year, the jury is still out. We don't know how effective Schedule 5 is in the state of Oklahoma. So, and when I say that, I want to also acknowledge that I have a lot of good friends in this room are from law enforcement, and thank God they're every day protecting our homes and our families and our communities. And what I'm telling you is I think we just have an honest disagreement as to what we think might be most effective. And it's nothing more than that. I want to acknowledge their hard work, but I don't want you to think I'm trying to disc anybody from law enforcement, because, again, I'm very, very thankful that they are there. So retailers, grocers, pharmacists legitimately disagree in what we think is the most effective. And if I can have just two more minutes, Mr. Chair. I talked to the former sheriff of Johnson County, Texas, who is a criminologist, a master's degree in criminology. He's been a deputy. He's been a sheriff for 20 years, although he lost the election last year. He said limiting the boxes of Sudafed will do absolutely no good whatsoever. He said what it's going to take instead is the efforts of churches and communities and civic groups and schools and teachers and pastors and the continued efforts of law enforcement and even the cooperative efforts of farmers, because in states like Kansas, farmers voluntarily are being asked to put these tags on their anhydrous ammonia tanks that go out in the field. It doesn't stop a person from stealing anhydrous ammonia, but if the tag is broken by somebody other than the farmer, they can at least report it to law enforcement, and law enforcement knows, you know, where the anhydrous is being stolen. So I guess in closing, I would just say that there are a number of amendments that are going to be offered today. I think they're good amendments. And I have a great deal of respect for Representative Johnson. I know he's really trying to do the right thing. I think these amendments we are offering are not trying to damage his bill, but to try to make them a little, make this bill a little bit more effective without causing a great deal of inconvenience to the commerce system, while still at the same time making the law as effective as I think he and others want it to be. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. Maybe when I get to the next two testifiers, and then we'll go for questions or amendments as members would like. Michelle Ate?
Good afternoon, Chairman Wilkin, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to testify in House File 572, testifying on behalf of pharmacists and the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. My name is Michelle Ate. I'm a pharmacist licensed to practice in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota. I've been professionally licensed for 9 years. I'm a pharmacy supervisor for the Walgreen Company and a member of MPHA. I currently supervise the operations of pharmacies, 25 pharmacies from Duluth on down to Faribault, Minnesota. Each day, our pharmacists in Minnesota not only oversee the filling of hundreds of prescriptions, they educate and counsel patients on issues regarding their medication compliance, potential adverse reactions, disease state management, and monitoring, and countless other topics related to their health care. Specifically, we counsel on issues involving the use of prescription and over-the-counter drugs. There's an ever-increasing number of prescription medications that are being developed, and also an increasing number of prescriptions as America has been aging. Therefore, the pharmacist's workload has increased dramatically. Pharmacists currently answer hundreds of questions regarding people's medication in person and over the phone every day. Pharmacists are professional healthcare providers and responsible business people who are very willing partners in the fight against the increasing abuse of methamphetamine. Many pharmacists have made voluntary and individualized adjustments to prevent the theft or misuse of the meth precursor products. Adjustments such as placing all of the products next to the pharmacy counter where they can be monitored carefully. Walgreens and many other community pharmacies have also implemented sales restrictions for some time. Currently, we have the two-package sales restriction. Pharmacists do support these sales restrictions, but believe that before restricting all solid adult strength pseudoephedrine-containing products, other alternatives must be explored. We support workable restrictions such as video surveillance, force tagging, and anti-theft shelving. It would be extremely difficult to place all the pseudoephedrine-containing products behind the counter and expect the pharmacist to monitor every cough, cold, and allergy product. Schedule 5 is also very problematic for pharmacists. The bill you're deliberating would require pharmacists to track the sales in a paper logbook for 30 days. This requirement is not only unfunded, but extremely time-consuming. At our pharmacies, we process thousands of transactions per day, and during the cough and cold season, the cough and cold products account for 20 to 40% of the transactions that you're asking us to document. Products such as the single entity Sudafed can be limited to pharmacy-only sales without placing them into a scheduled class. Gel caps and pediatric dosage form would be exempted under Schedule 5. Gel caps, as mentioned earlier, are not currently available as a single ingredient product. Gel caps currently contain many other products. I know the lady had mentioned them earlier, so since I'm a pharmacist, I won't go too long. I just thought I would let you know what each of these are and from a healthcare perspective. NyQuil does contain pseudoephedrine, and this would be available over the counter. It also contains Tylenol. It also contains dextromethorphan and doxylamine. Doxylamine is an antihistamine. You would not be able to take this medication and drive to work. It would make you very drowsy. Also, if you have asthma, you would be unable to take this product, or if you have a liver condition. DayQuil, which also contains pseudoephedrine, contains dextromethorphan in addition to acetaminophen. So once again, if you would have any type of liver condition, you would not be able to take the product. Vicks 44 has dextromethorphan and pseudoephedrine 60 milligrams. Dextromethorphan is a cough suppressant. I don't know that it would cause any unneeded, but I don't more than happen to take the flavor of the liquid and the inconvenience of taking a liquid as opposed to a tablet formulation. The one over here also has doxylamine in it, which is an antihistamine, which would be unable to take and drive. You couldn't drive and take that product. And then over here are the single entity products. So essentially what they're proposing is that a patient would either be unable to take a medication due to a health condition or would have to take unneeded ingredients in addition to the Sudafed to treat their cough or cold. The other problem with tracking is it does cut into the time that I'm using to check for prescription drug-drug interactions, patient compliance to their medications. Pharmacists are highly educated healthcare providers. Our time is best utilized counseling patients on the use of their medications and possible drug interactions. I spent 6 years at the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy. Currently, the students that graduate from that college all have doctorate degrees. They are healthcare providers. They are the only healthcare providers that spend that much time learning how drugs affect the human body. The paper logbooks will do nothing to prevent someone from visiting multiple pharmacies in a given time to acquire pseudoephedrine-containing products. They won't serve a purpose unless a statewide electronic network exists. Paper logs are cumbersome, inefficient, subject to human error and fraud, and do nothing to stop the practice we know as smurfing. Again, tracking purchases by a central electronic system is the only practical way to accomplish the purpose of a log. The purpose of a log is to track who buys what, where they buy it, and when they buy it. An effective long-term... Okay. Thank you, Chair Wilkin. I'll speed it up here. The long-term solution are our meth programs, education programs, which Buzz Anderson presented earlier. Another concern is that House File 573, the liability for logging is unclear. We are concerned about what liability the pharmacy faces and what expectation will be placed on our pharmacies to know which customers have been to other locations to purchase the precursor products. Our other concern is that whatever is passed should have strong preemption language, so it should include language that preempts all municipal, county, and home rules from enacting any legislature stronger than our state law. The preemption is needed so that retailers that operate statewide can be allowed to work with one set of guidelines. As Buzz mentioned, another concern of pharmacists is rural accessibility. There are pharmacies in the state where patients would need to travel an hour or greater than 60 miles to get to a pharmacy, and currently 10 to 12 more of these pharmacies close per year. Our state is currently 400 pharmacists short, and we don't want patients to have to drive more than an hour or 60 miles to simply treat a common cold. We support seeing a strong meth bill passed this session. We don't want to be made into law enforcement. We do support workable product restrictions that will not overly burden our pharmacists. Thank you for your time, and I'll stand for questions.
Brief questions. We've got one more witness. Can they wait till the next witness is done? No? Representative Mullery?
Mr. Chairman, it's for her. Do you want to bring her back?
That's fine. Let's just do it now. I'm mindful of the clock. We can come back this evening if we need to. So go ahead, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms.
Aite?
One question. I assume that if you have to put a lot more labor into each package sold, you're going to charge more for each package of Sudafed or box of Sudafed there. Do you have any idea what the cost would be, how many times the present cost would be?
Ms. Aite.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not qualified to answer that. It's a great question. It's something, you know, that would obviously be considered, and it would probably impact the cost, but I'm not qualified on that side. But thank you for the question.
Okay, Representative Goodwin, if you have a question.
I do. One of my concerns, AT, is that I have people in my district that have said that they can only take Sudafed because they have high blood pressure and they have to take decongestant instead of an antihistamine, and they have sinus infections and they have to take them ongoing, like we heard in the testimony here. I don't see anything in this bill that would provide for that, and I don't think it should be prescription because we know then the cost goes up. So I'm going to question you on that and ask you as a pharmacist, do you have a number of patients that have to take this medication versus some other medication on a regular basis where this would bother them? And the second question is, I see on page 4 here that we're making a pharmacists into criminals who violate this. So that concerns me because if the pharmacists have been selling this on an ongoing basis to people that they know, they're also giving high blood pressure pills to, and this is the only thing they can use, and suddenly they have to stop giving them more than 2 packages a month. What are the options for the folks, and what do the pharmacists think about suddenly being able to be convicted of a crime if they would continue to sell these products?
Okay. Ms. Aite.
Mr. Chair and Representative, to address your second question first, I know it's been brought up that a cashier or a technician would be allowed to sell these products back in the pharmacy. As a licensed professional, I would not feel comfortable allowing anybody in my department to sell a scheduled drug or to trust them with the logging. I believe the way the language is written that liability is unclear, and pharmacists would be unwilling to risk our license due to somebody unknowingly selling more than their allotted amount of Sudafed to a patient, which is why we would be in favor of a statewide electronic system so that that could be tracked and the liability would fall where the liability should be. To answer, that was part 2 of your question. So that does put us as healthcare professionals in an awkward situation. We wouldn't trust that responsibility to anyone else besides ourselves, which would take away from my time that I spend with the patients. To answer your first question, as to what I spoke to earlier, currently if somebody has a stuffed up nose or a cold, it's quite easy to take a Sudafed product and treat that. With the multiple ingredient products, you're not only treating that, you're taking other things that you may not necessarily need. As mentioned, Tylenol cannot exceed 4 grams in a day, so by taking this I'm actually adding Tylenol into my body as well, and if I have a liver function, that would be problematic. In addition, a lot of these products, any of the ones that are the nighttime products, would cause drowsiness, so you wouldn't be able to take them and function at work. In addition, asthmatics would be unable to take some of these products.
Representative Johnson, to that point.
Can I just follow up on a couple of those? With respect to the potential criminal liability, there is no criminal liability going to the pharmacist or the pharmacy for selling someone more than their 6 grams in a 30-day period, which isn't 2 boxes. It's more like 7 or 8 per person. That criminal liability goes to the person making the purchase. There would be criminal liability, the misdemeanor liability, if you failed to check someone's ID or have them sign the log or sold them more than two boxes in one visit. But I keep hearing we're going to have to sort through this this log each time, and that's not part of the bill. It's not required. There's also, I saw it on the shelf this weekend when I bought my pseudoephedrine products that I'm using today. There's a Sudafed PE that Pfizer has already put out, which does not have pseudoephedrine in it, so it's another option that's already on the market, and my guess is that is a response to states talking about this very issue. I also saw a Sudafed liquid cap, but I didn't buy it, and I should have, because I think it has what it listed was pseudoephedrine and a mucolytic. I don't know what that is. It's kind of a gross-sounding word, but it struck me as it just had the decongestant in it. So I don't think this is going quite as far overboard as some may suggest, because there are other options. And these products are still all available if you visit the pharmacist and sign the law.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. A.K.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you.
Bob Passavante?
Chairman Wilkin, committee members, I'll keep my comments very brief.
Can you please introduce yourself for the...
My name is Robert Passavante. I'm the Director of Pharmacy Operations for Coborn's. We're a grocery chain headquartered in St. Cloud, Minnesota. We have several grocery stores, some with, some without pharmacies. Of course, I'm a pharmacist myself, and we acknowledge the problem of methamphetamine in the state of Minnesota. But some of the consequences of the bill I just wanted to mention that I have concerns with. First of all, I am concerned with the bill in its present form about the increase in labor costs in the pharmacy and those costs being passed on to consumers, either in the cost of a single box of Sudafed or spreading that cost among prescriptions. Secondly, I am concerned about the impact on consumers and their accessibility to these products. Of course, it would be a good thing if methamphetamine addicts had to wait to get their Sudafed, but I think the impact is going to be mostly on consumers, the 99.9% of the people who come to our store, the good consumers who want the product and just have to be inconvenienced, because the way I see it, when you're in a very busy pharmacy, and this has been addressed by other people testifying, when you're in a very busy pharmacy, I can see people coming to the counter for a box of Sudafed and being asked to wait 15 or 20 minutes. And then my third point simply is that in the grocery store environment, we currently have the experience and the ability to regulate items like, for example, tobacco. And we believe that they should be regulated behind the counter, but not necessarily in the pharmacy. Thank you for your time. I'll take any questions.
Questions of this witness or any of the others at this point? Representative Zellers.
Sure. Maybe this is... I don't know if it was Representative Goodwin or Mullery's question. Do you have an idea what it would add to a box? You know, for you said it would be an increase.
Right now, we haven't done an analysis of exactly how much it would add to a box. I will tell you that to fill a prescription right now costs us about $6, and the having to keep this in a paper log. My concern would be, how do I know without flipping through pages and pages and pages that somebody got only two packages or whatever the limit is in a month? Our feeling was, if we would put it in the pharmacy computer, that would electronically track the purchases. We pull it up on a patient profile. Well, to do all that is a cost. That's practically like filling it as a prescription, and then, of course, everybody gets involved. Will it be as much as a prescription, $6? No, maybe it's $3 or $4, but it will add some cost.
One follow-up,
Mr.
Chairman. What is you said it was about $6 to fill. What is the time time-wise to fill a prescription? Does it take 5-10 minutes to do a background verification? You know, to go through the process, and what would that difference be during like a work day?
Well, it depends on the day. I don't have a specific numbers off the top of my head how long it takes to fill a prescription. I imagine it takes anywhere from 2 to 3 minutes for a refill to up to 10 minutes by the time you review the profile, check for allergies, and then run it through insurance, of course.
That's it. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Passavanti, you're talking about this bill, I think, as though it requires these drugs to be in a pharmacy. And as I'm reading the bill here on page 4, it just says behind a checkout counter where the public is not permitted. So that first part of my question is, in these stores that don't have a pharmacy, I mean, you could sell them behind some kind of a counter, correct? And also the amendment that the second part of my question goes to the amendment that we approved at the beginning of this hearing that adds a pharmacy clerk to the list of people that can sell the stuff under the bill. And I guess my question is, what exactly is that, if you know, and does that sort of satisfy the concern that, you know, that some of these stores without a pharmacy can you just designate someone a pharmacy clerk and let them be responsible?
No, you couldn't. And I'll tell you why. Because if you make this a Schedule 5 drug, Schedule 5 drugs would have to be, according to this law, sold by a pharmacist, by a pharmacy. So you wouldn't be able to sell them in a store without a pharmacy, the way I read it.
Representative Johnson, would you care to address that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, it does say that it can be behind a counter, but a pharmacist technician or pharmacist clerk must sell it. So I would probably have to agree you're going to need a pharmacy in the store in order to sell these products as opposed to the other products.
Representative Liebling.
Sure, but Representative, is there a definition somewhere of what a pharmacy clerk is? Is that a recognized label, something that requires a license or
can I answer that? There is a definition of a pharmacy.
Passavante, would you? We need to go through the chair, so we just keep track of things. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A pharmacy technician does need to be registered by the state of Minnesota, as does a pharmacist. A pharmacy clerk does not.
I have Representative Fritz, Gunther, and Moe. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Passavante, when did we stop needing a prescription to get Sudafed?
I don't believe we ever did need a prescription for Sudafed.
And Benadryl?
Mr. Passavante.
Benadryl, it was a number of years ago, but the 25 milligram was always available. The 50 milligram, I believe, is still a prescription.
Representative Fritz? Okay.
Well, I go back 40 years in nursing, and I seem to remember people having to have a script for the ingredients, the pseudoephedrine and the Benadryl. And having said that, they would have had to obtain that from their physician. My concern is, when did we start medicating ourselves though with all of this? And it's just become, to me, it's just it's just rampant.
Mr. Passavante, you remember when that
doctor?
I'm sorry, what was the question, Mr. Chairman?
Do you remember when we started medicating?
No, I don't remember that.
But this, a follow-up to
when
that.
When they invented aspirin.
Well, again, as a nurse, you know that every drug is a potential killer. You know, we all learned that in pharmacology. And so this is a very serious ingredient that we're talking about here today. I don't mean to make light of it. So, but I do think that we have a very serious problem here, and this is something that I take very seriously. And I do think that we do over-medicate ourselves. That's a part of that. However, having said that, this must be a big business for Walgreens and Colburn and folks that package that stuff as well. So I could see that, you know, that side of it I think needs to be addressed too.
Okay, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned $6 to fill a prescription. What does Blue Cross Blue Shield give you to fill a prescription?
Mr. Passavante.
I would say the average amount. Boy, that's a loaded question.
I know.
Do you want to know what they give me as far as the official dispensing fee, or what are we making on an average on a prescription?
What do they give you for official dispensing fee?
The official dispensing fee ranges anywhere from, I would guess, $2 to $4. Well, but we make probably on the average of about $6 or $7 a prescription.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as a grocer, I know what it feels like to make it up in volume.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question for Representative Johnson. When we were looking at the slide presentations, there were there were the examples of Missouri, which the condition this behind the counter didn't help, and then you showed a bar chart was shown of Oklahoma, where actually they've been able to get ahead of this a little bit, or at least start a decline. I'm not a lawyer, and looking through this little challenging for me. Could you make it just clear for us what the difference is and how this how those two scenarios are different and how this would reflect that?
Yeah. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, my understanding of what Missouri tried originally was to have a box limit, which this has, in one visit, and then to allow the drug to be behind the counter or within plain view or within 10 feet or something like that of the clerk, but it did not require a pharmacist. So it had that extra, it didn't require a pharmacist, and it also allowed that extra option of keeping the drug within sight of the clerk. That's my understanding of it.
Okay, Representative Moe?
And in Oklahoma, their version is like this.
Yep.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this question is for Mr. O'Malley from the DCA. And I'd call attention to page 5, lines 19 and 20, and it specifically calls into question the items on the far side of the desk. By analogy, when I was a kid a long, long time ago, if my folks would let me drive the car, I'd use the car to get someplace. If my folks wouldn't let me use the car, I'd get on my bike. My concern for, I guess, Mr. O'Malley, as well as perhaps the author, we take that stuff out of their hands. They're going to ride the bike and go over and grab the DayQuil or the gel caps. And I'll tell you a little bit more about my background on it, is that my understanding, and perhaps Mr. O'Malley can address it, is that there is apparently the gel caps in particular. You can literally boil that off and get to the Sudafed portion of it by, apparently it's an hour-long boiling process in it ammonia, anhydrous ammonia, and then you get to the chemical. I'm just afraid that we're going to be back here with Mr. Johnson again next year amending it to take into account that portion. So with that, I'll...
Mr. O'Malley?
Go ahead.
I'm not capable of describing the exact process that you would have to go through with the gel caps. I do know from talking to scientists in the DCA laboratory and from information obtained from the Drug Enforcement Administration in Washington, D.C., that it is a more cumbersome process. It is possible. It is not as simple as the recipe that's out there now. Could we anticipate that they would move to that? They may. I'm not sure. And to be... very direct, I think it may lead to us being back here next year. Again, we have not found that in Minnesota anywhere, and we've done a lot of labs, and we've talked to law enforcement in other states that have been inundated, and they just haven't seen that. Again, it is possible, but I don't know that it'll happen.
Representative Atkins.
On that note, then, Mr. Chair, what I'd suggest, and as much as I'd like seeing Representative Johnson and Mr. O'Malley come back, is that, and I didn't prepare an amendment for it because I wasn't aware of it. My suggestion would just be by motion, either delete that portion, or if the chair would not be comfortable with that, it is substantive, mind you, but or by motion, just lay it over so that we could take that portion of it up at our next hearing. Just that small, what it would do is lines 19 and 20 would be deleted. So that on page 5, Representative Rukavina, and it would just treat those, they're precursor drugs. There's no question that they are meth precursor drugs. What it would do is just simply treat them the same, so that when kids are faced with that choice between the car and the bike, the car is taken away and they go to the bike, because my assumption is that's where they're going to go, left with no other options. And since I didn't anticipate the need for it via amendment, I just moved that it be laid over, unless you'd be comfortable taking it up as to be deleted today. Representative Yarrow says it's technical. I don't agree that it's technical, Representative Yarrow, but whatever the chair is most comfortable with, I certainly am.
Representative Atkins, this bill does have several other stops. Maybe Representative Johnson could let us know, but they could be dealt with in other committees, possibly. I do think it's probably a little more than technical.
I agree.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson first.
please don't lay the bill open. Let me just say that, because we have been...
A long road.
Yeah, we have been following a very precise process, including floor re-referrals, and right now I have at least four more stops, if not more than that. I think that you have a fair issue. My understanding is that it is much more difficult to do that, that in Oklahoma, when they passed essentially this, they didn't see it happening. Is it possible that somebody could figure out how to do it and it becomes all the rage in Minnesota? It's possible. And then I would be back. But right now, I would prefer that we leave the bill as it is on that particular issue.
Representative Atkins, I'd suggest that it is not so much riding the bike. It's probably riding the unicycle. Not all of us can do that. And not all of us can figure out, not all of the meth cooks can figure out how to boil that stuff out of the gel tabs. This is going to public safety still, or what?
Jobs, public safety, ways and means, taxes.
I would suggest, yeah, it's got a long road to go. I would suggest that particular issue be dealt with in public safety, because what we're trying to deal with is just, that is in a section we're dealing with, but it's probably not in the commerce-y type purview, but you could disagree with me on that.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative Rukavina.
I'll yield to Representative Atkins to make this last point.
Just to that point, my understanding from the Iowa authorities is it takes 1 hour to boil out the gel cap surroundings and get to the set. So I do believe that it's not riding a unicycle. Although Representative Johnson's journey looks like he's going to be riding his bicycle for the Tour de France through this committee process. But I do not believe that it would be best to... That is the heart and soul of what the Commerce Committee is designed to deal with, is that very issue. And if that means going till 2:30 rather than 2:15, I don't mean to monopolize it, but I do think it's our jurisdiction to address that issue, Mr. Chair.
We do have the room reserved for room 10 after session, and we will be back if we don't get this done by about 2:30 or so. Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, to this point, and I've been wrong to hear when you two were on training wheels, so, you know.
What did I start?
An amendment to delete something. I mean, this is no big deal. It's a 24-hour rule requirement you're going to require, and I don't know if that's what you're saying here today, that he offers an amendment to delete two lines in a bill. Mr. Chair, we're getting to the point where we might as well not come to committee meetings.
That's not what I said. It's more than technical. It's really up to the committee. I mean, this is an oral amendment. It is a fairly simple oral amendment.
Exactly. And so if we can't do this in committee now under new rules, because 24 hours ago he didn't tell you he was going to do this. Well, good. Let's do it. I'll vote. Come on. Did you make the motion?
Are you making the motion?
I have made the motion. Okay. I would withdraw it as a... I made it as a motion to lay over. I don't believe that's appropriate, especially with the journey that Representative Johnson is on. I would make it as a motion to delete lines 19 and 20 on page 5.
The Representative Atkins moves the deletion of lines 19 and 20 on page 5.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Colt.
Representative Johnson, could you just speak to Representative Atkins' motion? I'm interested in your perspective on this.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, I would urge a no vote on this. Everything that I have seen says that we are safe to keep these on the market as is, without the extra restrictions. If there is information or studies out there that says that 2 months after we do this, everybody's going to be using these things, again, I would change it or I'd be back. It's not out there. I certainly haven't seen it. That's not what happened in Oklahoma. I don't think it's what'll happen here.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it sounds to me like you're giving us some assurances, at least, that if Representative Atkins has some of these studies, if he can show you what the people in Iowa are talking about, that this is something you'll work on as this moves forward. All right, thank you.
Further questions, Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would speak against us hearing this amendment at this time. I think it's much more than technical. I mean, I think a lot of us, especially from rural Minnesota, sitting listening to the discussion on the bill, and we know what a serious problem meth is, but we also have issues about accessibility.
and the fact that this then would only be sold in pharmacies and things like that. And taking out these two lines changes that consideration for us again, and I just feel like we haven't had a chance to hear enough about that. And I, you know, I guess if it comes down to it, I'm more concerned about the meth problem than anything else, but I, you know, I trust Representative Johnson that if this then becomes a problem, that we'll be right back hearing it again right away. So I just think today that I think this is, without the 24 hours and the chance to have people come in and actually testify more about this particular issue, I guess I don't feel comfortable with this committee voting on this amendment.
Representative Liebling, I don't disagree with you. I'm probably going to vote the same way you are. When it's an oral amendment to do something pretty simple to a bill, it's kind of hard to rule on the 24-hour rule. It's relatively minor in structure, even though it's major in policy implications. Representative Goodwin?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I'm wondering if this, if that would even change your bill, because here you've got the, on line 24, page 5, you've got that the Board of Pharmacy and the Department of Public Safety should certify methamphetamine precursor drugs that meet the requirements of paragraph K and publish an annual listing of these drugs. So there's really no reason to exclude that because it could still be included by your language down here. So it wouldn't make a big difference to take out in lines 19 and 20. They could still certify that, as except that if you leave those in, they cannot certify gels or capsules as, or gels or liquid as a precursor drug.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Johnson?
Actually, that's not quite correct. This would change the bill dramatically. It would take these products and put them behind the pharmacist's counter. This bill does not do that. Now, the Board of Pharmacy can certify that something essentially is impossible to be made into meth. There is no such product right now, as far as I know. I'm not claiming it's impossible to make meth out of these. It's just my understanding is very difficult.
Okay. Further questions?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, you know, you're here today with a pretty serious bill about a serious problem, and if your goal is to stop the spreading of the use of methamphetamine, I think Representative Atkins' amendment is a very good amendment. Your bill also is going to cause a lot of hardship in rural Minnesota, like Representative Liebling just said, and many, many towns across my district that don't have a pharmacy where someone's going to have to drive 30 miles, like this woman was talking about, to drive, buy something for her children. So, but if you do, if you're concerned about what a precursor drug is for making this, it isn't going to take these meth folks very long to figure out how to use that. So you might as well go all the way right here now, you know. And I would urge support for the Atkins Amendment because this stuff has to get taken care of right here in this committee, I believe.
The motion is page 5, delete lines 19 and 20. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
I have a purely technical, non-controversial clarifying amendment.
God bless you.
Did not meet the 24-hour rule. If I could just describe it very briefly.
Please do.
On page, thank you, Mr. Chairman, on page 4, line 10, it says to sign a written, and my old amendment would be, for electronic document detailing. And, you know, you go into a Best Buy or a Walmart, or you're not buying Sudafed, Best Buy probably, but you go into one of these stores, and you can either sign a log, or they have you, when you put your credit card in there, they have you sign that electronic box thing, so it's not actually the document, but it'd be an you're still signing. The person, I know to deter someone that's purchasing, they want people to actually physically sign. They're still signing, but it would be on that electronic equipment. And so it would just say to sign a written or electronic document.
And just to make sure I have the amendment, on page 4, line 10, after the word written, insert the words or electronic.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids moves that amendment. Any discussion to the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, it's me.
Representative Johnson.
I'm fine with that amendment. This would match Senate language.
I don't believe it's controversial or clarifying. Someone will make it controversial, I'm sure. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, I think we all have the amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Further amendments or discussion? Representative Simpson?
Yes, I have Amendment A-20 that I'd like to introduce at this time.
Representative Simpson moves the A-20 amendment. Representative Simpson?
Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is to take care of some concerns that were addressed about the Fourth Amendment rights. I'd like to have lines 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 removed from my amendment, please.
You're striking lines 8 through 12
correct.
From the amendment?
And line 7 also.
And, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yep.
You can incorporate that, right? Okay. Representative Simpson incorporates into his amendment the deletion of lines 7 through 12 of the A-20 amendment. Representative Simpson, you want to explain what the rest of the amendment does?
Yes, I will. Thank you. Basically, I'd like to first of all thank Representative Johnson for bringing this bill forward. We do have a rural meth issue, and there's nobody sitting around this table that doesn't agree with that. Commissioner O'Malley, I have nothing but respect for you and the job you're doing. It's a tough job out there. But I have to go back to the same thing that we've been talking about, and that's rural access, and I'm going to have to stick with that. In my amendment, what I'm proposing to do is keep all the restrictions in order that Representative Johnson has. They're behind the counter, locked up, limited two packages, 18 years old, signed the log book or electronic log that we just put on. And what I'm asking to do is to allow this product to be sold in retail grocery stores and convenience stores and pharmacies. I guess that, you know, when you start talking about these issues, we've had a great response of people in here today giving us two sides of both sides of the story, and visiting with local law officials, I've heard both sides of it. Just a moment ago, we almost took gel caps in liquid form off of the table, which would really create a problem in rural Minnesota, so it would make it worse. I guess the one thing that gets down to is in the case of fairness, in the case of selling this product in a position, in a place where we don't have access to a pharmacy, is what's the difference between an $8 an hour pharmacy clerk or an $8 an hour grocery clerk or a convenience store clerk? I believe our people are responsible, whether they're one or the other. And I think that the amendment I'm introducing just keeps some common sense into this, and that's where I'm at.
Yeah. Discussing the amendment, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I would speak against the amendment, and Representative Simpson and I have talked about this issue, as have several of you, a lot. I think it's a legitimate concern that there are some places without pharmacists and there are some towns without pharmacies, and this is going to be more of an inconvenience in those places. However, these products are still available. I think that having this extra requirement to make it a little more difficult, a little more intimidating for a potential meth cook to buy these products is a good thing. But I will leave it up to the committee to make that decision.
Further discussion, Representative Rukavina.
I'd like to speak on behalf of Representative Simpson's bill. And, you know, I can think of Tower, which is a community where I used to actually be the milkman and deliver milk to Martela's Drug, but it's not there anymore. And it's about almost 23 miles for those people in that area to drive to Virginia and probably 24 miles to Ely. Sometimes, Representative Johnson, I think, now that you're a statewide candidate, by the way, you should get a grasp on rural Minnesota. And, you know, and I don't think some of you folks do know what it's like out there and the distances that people have to drive. And I think, you know, Representative Simpson makes a very good point. You're going to have a person that's probably not paid very much an hour in a pharmacy make the same decision as somebody in a grocery store or a convenience store. And you know, it makes sense. If it can be locked up in a pharmacy, it can be locked up in a grocery store, convenience store. And I would hope that, you know, all of us around the table use a little common sense, and I'd support the Simpson Amendment. I hope everyone does.
Representative Clark.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm going to disagree with my colleague, Representative Gavina, and agree with the author of the bill on this. The difference between those two, Representative Simpson, is one is registered and has a registration or a license to lose.
No.
And it sounds like...
No.
Well, it says it's registered. That's one of the differences.
We amended it.
We put on the amended.
Did we take out the registration?
No. Ms. Who are you directing the question to?
Well, I guess I was thinking that there's more... If I'm not... If we have the word's still in here, if your amendment isn't on, what we have is registered pharmacy clerk.
Mr. Chairman, can I just
Representative Johnson?
Pharmacy technician, I mean.
Representative Clark, we added an amendment right at the beginning that includes a pharmacy clerk, which does not have to be licensed, although I believe they have to be under the direction of a pharmacist.
Representative Clark.
Well, at any rate, I think that's an important distinction if they have to be under. I guess I'd like some assurance that there is that connection. Do we know?
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding, but I don't want to give an assurance until I'm certain of that. My understanding from talking to pharmacists.
Representative Clark?
Part of my concern about this is, I mean, I do think this is an incredibly, incredibly difficult problem. And actually, I know a fair amount about rural Minnesota and care a lot about it, and I have I guess that's where so much of the problem is happening, and I actually know relatives who will be inconvenienced by having to go to the other side, and I know the same relatives of children who become meth addicts, and I'm just concerned about it. I just feel like we really need to make this a very, very tough issue. I can remember fighting this fight when we were talking about sniffing glue and paint and stuff in stores, and we had to fight the industries. I thought that was too terrible that we'd have to have you know, paint behind some of the products that people were sniffing. And you know, I just think this is such a serious problem. I guess I think most rural folks, I don't know, may be willing to trade off the inconvenience for the protection that they get. So that's what I think based on the experience that I've had with those folks. My
Representative Zellers and Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in working with Representative Simpson on this as well, and Representative Recovina, I have been out in the sticks. My family grew up there, not in this state, but way out far, and I know what it's like when, yeah, you got a sniffle and you can drive 5 miles or 10 miles where there's a gas station, or to drive to a pharmacy, which is 40 miles away. This is common sense legislation. I would support Representative Simpson. I do think that we're going to be making it much more difficult under Representative Johnson's bill for these meth labs to expand and to continue to grow. But again, we do have to have a little bit of common sense here, and I think that's what Representative Simpson's amendment brings.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, I think the common sense thing works, but this is statewide policy, and I have to say that in public health throughout the state, when we've done youth sting operations, we find throughout the whole state that even our current regulations about youth and minor access to tobacco and alcohol is pretty, you know, has problems with implementing this. And I think that I am sympathetic, though, to the rural areas where there is a pharmacy scarcity, but I'm wondering whether there's some creative solutions that could be explored as this bill moves on, like authorizing rural hospitals to sell these products to the public, or narrowly applying this to only areas that don't have a licensed pharmacy within, to stores that operate when there isn't a licensed pharmacy within 30 miles or 10 miles or whatever is a reasonable thing. People are not dying from lack of access to these cold remedies. They may be somewhat uncomfortable. People are literally dying from the effects of this. And, you know, we're seeing it in so many tragedies throughout our whole state. I think we really do need to address problems in small parts of the state with targeted solutions, and I'm hoping that those will evolve as this bill proceeds, but I will vote against the Simpson Amendment.
Representative Simpson.
To that point, I don't think we want $50 per aspirin delivery costs for people to buy this, as we hear on cost for hospital care. So I don't think we want to go to local hospitals to be buying these products.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. There's fewer rural hospitals than there is rural pharmacies.
Further discussion? Seeing none, to the A20 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No. No.
The motion prevails. Are there any further amendments or discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative House.
I have two amendments. The A20, because of my great respect for Representative Johnson, I will not offer.
I meant
the A19, Mr. Chairman. I will not offer that, but I am going to offer the A22 amendment.
Representative House moves the A22 amendment. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have an oral an amendment to make to that correction. On page 1, line 18, where it says or, strike that and put and.
Representative House incorporates the amendment to his amendment on line 18, striking the word or and inserting the word and. Representative House.
And, Mr. Chairman, just so you know, Mr. Pender will have to make an adjustment on the amendment on line 3, where it says page 12 after line 26 does not fit the bill.
Mr. Pender, you have a correction for that?
Mr. Chair, it should be page 13.
On page...
So on line 3 of the amendment where it says page 12, it should be page 13.
Representative Howes incorporates that change into his amendment. Representative Howes, you want to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be as brief and as quick as I can. Representative Simpson's amendment, being a good amendment, didn't go quite far enough. Unfortunately, a lot of my convenience stores do not have locked display cases. They'd have to go purchase that. They have to find a place to put it because behind the counter is very limited. And also, it's very difficult to keep a logbook and those kinds of things. And also, with this amendment, requires training of the clerk on meth use, which is a plus, and I think Representative Johnson would be encouraged by that. So with all due respect to Representative Johnson and Representative Simpson's amendment, which was good, I think mine's a little bit better, and I appreciate your support.
Yeah, discussion of the amendment. Representative Johnson, you want to address it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hollis, I appreciate the amendment. I would urge a no vote on this amendment. We just watered the bill down a little bit. I think it in probably a reasonable way. This is going to take it a rather significant step further. For convenience stores, this would say not only does a pharmacist not have to sell it, but you don't have the log anymore. It doesn't restrict this to folks who are 18 and older. And it also provides more options for selling the product. So I would strongly urge a no vote on this amendment. And that's probably all I have to say.
Discussion. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, we almost wipe out the bill with this amendment.
Okay. Further discussion, Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I was just noticing one of your comments, Representative Howe, is the training of employees involved in the sales of products. That seems like a good part. I don't support the amendment, but I think that seems like a good part, and I'm wondering if the author has considered that being part of this bill.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, actually in the bill right now, there's not a requirement for training, but there is a provision limiting liability if a store does provide training, so there's a significant incentive for that in there, and I would agree with you that that's very important. But I can look at strengthening that further.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just curious the Representative Mullery's statement that it would undo the bill. I mean, it would seem to me you'd have to drive around all around the state in order to get enough to make enough of the Sudafed or whatever it is to make even one sale. I mean, it seems like it's pretty common sense to me. Because I had a pharmacist email me yesterday, and he's actually a very good Democrat, so I won't read most of his email, but I do want to ask this question of Representative Johnson, because he's talking about Governor Pallante here, and he says, does he know that you can order 200 Sudafed a day from his beloved Canadian online pharmacy? How long before the meth head figures this out? Hell, he'll probably will encourage it because it's only $32 for 200 in Canada and a lot cheaper than the USA. So I guess my question is, number one, is this true? And number two, will Commissioner Campion be arresting the governor later on in the day if we pass this bill? Is this true or not?
You really want to answer that question?
Is this true? Can you go on the...
Sure. Yeah, you can buy it.
On the governor's plan.
Oh, I don't know if it's on the governor's plan.
It says you can go on the governor's Canadian online. And
My guess, Mr. Chairman, is you can go on to all kinds of sites and buy Sudafed on the Internet, which is an option for people who want to cook meth. But I don't think you just give in on everything else because we can't fill every hole.
So, Mr. Chair, my point being, Representative Mallory, is that I think this amendment's a little less innocuous than what can happen right now with our own government approval in the state of Minnesota by the governor's...
Okay, members, we're going to wrap this up by quarter till, and if we're not done with the bill, then we'll come back after session. Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, I will close. The amendment is a good amendment. Representative Mallory is suggesting this eliminates the basis of the bill. It does not. It simply makes it a little more practical for rural Minnesota. And, you know, I'm getting real tired of metro area legislators continuing to dictate or ban or do this or that because it helps in the metro area, but it kills rural Minnesota. And I think this is a good amendment for rural Minnesota, and I appreciate your support.
Yes.
I think you just lost the metro.
Representative Goodwin.
Tell me something I don't know.
Representative Goodwin.
Quickly, I want to say that we are focusing on this part of the bill, but the bill is a lot more than just the sale of this. And the rest of the bill, I really think is very, very good. And this is the one part that I think we do have some problems with. So I'm supporting Representative Hall's amendment.
Representative Hey, no hugging. Representative Taylor.
Representing a rural district, all of these rural issues are very real to me and all of these concerns. But I'm also taking into account all of the people that I have worked with and talked with over time, and we're talking about convenience here, and I certainly can recognize the convenience of needing to go maybe to a grocery store or a convenience store to purchase this. But I think we also need to be concerned with how convenient is it when our sheriff's department is all tied up with a meth lab, and how convenient is it when our health and human services department is all tied up with dealing with out-of-home placements, and when our school counselors are having more and more of their time dealing with students that are having meth problems. It's not an easy concern here, and I realize, you know, there's convenience, and I would echo what Representative Goodwin says about having difficulty with this portion of the bill, and I would rather imagine that perhaps we all have that, but I just think we all need to think about convenience and what that really means to us, and I know that, you know, I'm just as happy to be able to purchase my Sudafed from a grocery store. I think we need to consider that, and I respectfully say, I'm sorry, Representative House, I would have to disagree on this issue.
Good. To the A.2 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. To the bill, any further questions?
Okay.
Seeing none, Representative Severson renews his motion that House File 572, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Jobs, Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. We have the minutes of the meeting of March 9th.
So move, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids moves the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. And we are adjourned.